Good morning. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Robert Berry, and I represent the plaintiff and appellant Barbara Williams in this case. Ms. Williams filed this equitable garnishment action against the insurers in the Circuit Court of Lincoln County, Missouri, under a very specific Missouri statute, 379.200. It is a unique Missouri statute that allows recovery of any judgment creditor against insurers who wrongfully deny coverage. In the case, Ms. Williams seeks to satisfy through insurance a judgment previously obtained by a class of victims in a prior, separate, and now final Missouri action. Although Ms. Williams is a class representative from the prior case, there are no class rules at issue in this case, there are no class procedures, and nothing in Rule 23 or its state analog in the state of Missouri, Rule 5208, are pleaded in the petition for the garnishment action. And that's because no class issues can arise here.
Does that have to be the case in order for this to be a class action? Are you saying the petition has to mention some sort of class action procedure before it can count as a class action under CAFA?
Yes, Your Honor, that is our position, and I believe it is the position that Congress took when it defined the scope of this court's jurisdiction under CAFA. And Your Honor's question is the first issue we'd like to address today, is that did the district court err in denying the motion to remand by not looking to the term class action as defined by CAFA.
One of the problems with that definition is that in defining class action, it uses the term class action, which is not helpful.
Your Honor, the courts that have addressed the issue certainly have said that that can be circular, but it is also unclear, also unambiguous.
But you've got this Addison case that's kind of against you, don't you?
The Seventh Circuit looked behind the definition of class action in CAFA and looked to the substance of the complaint. We think incorrectly, but it did in fact do it. And frankly, Your Honors, that's the decision I think that the court faces today when deciding the scope of its jurisdiction. If this court concludes that the fact that Ms. Williams is a class representative from a prior class is sufficient to make this a class action, we lose the jurisdiction question.
Isn't she still, as a practical matter, acting as a class representative? She is not an individual person seeking this judgment.
That is correct. She is a representative, Your Honor.
And so why doesn't that automatically make her, just as a practical matter for her fiduciary responsibilities to the class, make her a representative in this case?
Your Honor, the reason it doesn't, well, she is a representative in this case, and
but
she does have fiduciary duties.
What obligates her to them?
She has a final binding judgment and mandate from the Missouri State Court designating her as the class representative in this case. And the Missouri court sent her out to say, please go collect these matters, collect the money, and bring it back to us, the Missouri State Court, to distribute. I think this is the question. 397.200, on its face, does not include any Rule 23-like requirements. Nothing that happens in a Rule 23 case is at issue in 397.200. And I think the critical issue here, the thing that makes it different from, say, this court's decision in Brown, where it looked at the Arkansas law and said there are class elements involved, specifically by a Supreme Court rule from Arkansas that did that, 397.200 applies to any judgment creditor, and that's it. If Barbara Williams had won a claim as an individual, she would have status to stand in the shoes of the insured as an individual. If she was a trustee, the same thing. The fact that she happens to represent a class, and the class from a prior final judgment is the judgment creditor, we don't think converts this into a class action. Historically, this case just would have, it's a collection case.
One distinction between this case and Brown is that in Brown, the court noted that Rule 23 was used as a guide in those kinds of actions, and that's not true in this. This is just a collection action.
Your Honor, that, I think, is the salient decision. When the Supreme Court in AU Optronics said, how do we read CAFA, the Supreme Court said, we start our analysis not with the substance of what we think we see, but we look at what the case was filed under. And when you read the petition here, it is abundantly clear that while she's a representative, a fact numerous courts have had no concern with, but while she is a representative, when you look at the claims she filed, the only claim she has stated is a 397.200. So I think the case is, when you read 397.200, does it contain any of the hallmarks that this court would expect to see in Rule 23 or its state analog? And the opposite of that is true. Again, no certification is required or even allowed. The only reason certification is an issue here is that this particular judgment creditor seeking to levy on insurance assets happened to be a class. And this is what I think the Seventh Circuit did wrong. And I think part of the problem in Addison Automatics was the court, there was a lot of coy pleading in that case. I think the plaintiff did appear to be playing games. He or she, I forget which it was, filed as an individual, was hiding from the fact that they had fiduciary duties. And what the court in Addison Automatic said is, look, the fact that you may only proceed as a class representative and the fact that you have fiduciary duties somehow converts this into a class action. But the two basic principles the Seventh Circuit relied upon are uncontroversial. It's true. Ms. Williams has fiduciary duties to the class. They're just in a prior case. And she's answerable to those fiduciary duties. And the court of Lincoln County, Missouri, would have a serious problem if she didn't bring money back as the mandate from the court was. But the court used those two principles and then stopped reading the statute, didn't ask what the case in Illinois was filed under.
Let's suppose this. Suppose there had been a recovery here and the money had been put in escrow or something and invested, and the investor had embezzled the money. The class representative could surely bring an action against the investor, right, for a breach of fiduciary duty or something like that?
I would believe that
wouldn't be a class action.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor, and it would be consistent.
Somebody's got to be able to sue, and it must be the head cheese, right?
That's who does it.
Fiduciary.
Yes, Your Honor. And so basically what the Seventh Circuit seemed to conclude is that anything a class representative does to collect on a judgment after a class action is final must be a class action. And it's interesting because the court relied upon a continuing jurisdiction or a continuing class action doctrine. And of course, it's not what Congress did, and that's not what the text of the CAFA says, but it creates additional problems that the Seventh Circuit didn't consider. In essence, in order for the insureds to have any jurisdiction to remove this case under 1441A, this court's precedent and the statute itself says the action must be an original action. Otherwise, we can't be here. It can't be removed. So for purposes of bringing the case into federal court, they're relying on the notion that this is a new case when they read 1441A. When they turn and they read CAFA, however, they ask this court to say, no longer consider it a new case. Consider it a continuation of the old case. And that creates something of a problem. And historically, the courts have dealt with ancillary proceedings like collections in different ways. When you go back in this court's precedent, we see for a long time, garnishment actions weren't removable at all. And the reason they weren't removable is the courts considered them to be somewhat ancillary. They were connected, and if the original action was or wasn't removed, there was nothing further to discuss. Well, that rule over time has changed in many jurisdictions. It's changed in the Eighth Circuit, and they're relying on that change here to say, okay, we have a new case. For federal jurisdiction, we'd like you to consider it new under 1441A. However, we'd like you to stop considering it new for CAFA. And we think that tension creates a legal inconsistency that doesn't make sense, and it's inconsistent with the plain text of CAFA. When the district court here entered its ruling and said, well, you're allowed to seek removal under CAFA either before or after class certification, that's true. We don't quarrel with that. But the language that allows you to do that specifically says you can seek such removal before or after certification in that action. The language was referring to the action where the certification occurred, which is really consistent with this court's continuing jurisdiction doctrines. And so from our perspective, I think this is the question the court faces. If the mere fact that she is a class representative is enough to make the second case a class action, we lose on this issue. But every other circuit, with the exception of the Seventh Circuit that's addressed the issue, has said we don't do that. Being a representative isn't enough. We need to read the statute that the case was filed under. And if it doesn't look and smell and sound like Rule 23 or its analog, Congress said no federal jurisdiction. The other main issue we want to discuss today is once we were in federal court, the district court granted the insurer's motion for judgment on the pleadings. This issue, and I think the key question for this court in this insurance case, is whether the insurance can establish as a matter of law, and that's the key piece, as a matter of law, that the substances at issue in the underlying action, in this case alpha particles and coliform bacteria, are legally excluded from their coverage. There was no evidence in this case. This wasn't a summary judgment. Ms. Williams argued, based upon the well-pleaded allegations, that you couldn't do that. In this lawsuit, she has alleged that those two substances are not a solid, liquid, gaseous, or thermal irritant or contaminant.
Is it that she alleged they were not, or she just didn't allege that they were?
In this case, she alleged that they were not. This is the insurance case where it matters. In the underlying case, she simply alleged that they were alpha particles slash the radionuclides and the coliform bacteria. That they never alleged in the original case they were solids, they were liquids, they were gases.
Did they allege they were contaminants?
They alleged they were contaminants, and here's why I think this decision came prematurely and ultimately wrong. And you're right. The district court found the word pollutant and contaminant in the original petition and said, aha, that must fall within the exclusion. But here's the problem. None of the insurance policies in this case exclude all pollutants or all contaminants. They're very specific. They only exclude pollutants or contaminants that meet a very specific definition. They must be a solid, liquid, gas, or thermal irritant or contaminant. It goes on to list a number of specific things. Now, it doesn't list radiation or coliform bacteria. And as we cited in our briefs, and as the court knows, many policies do. Many policies will say we do not include radiation, regardless of whether it's a solid, liquid, or gas. So the question then becomes, when the insureds read the initial underlying petition, is there no basis upon which coverage could attach? And they gambled. They assumed that their exclusions would apply. They didn't file for a declaratory relief action or anything of the such. And they just decided, okay, we've concluded that we think ultimately these are not solids, liquids, or gases. And of course, in the context of radiation, it's not true. The evidence in the underlying case, which ultimately was brought forth in the petition here and in the judge's order, from the chair of the physics department at Washington University, says subatomic particles don't qualify as the states of matter that are listed here.
Wasn't there also the idea that there was, is it radium that was there, that is where it was emanating from? I mean, was there a contested fact as to whether radium was present?
Well, there's certainly no allegations as to whether radium was a solid, liquid, or gas in the underlying dispute either.
Is that a dispute? Is it your position that your client disputes whether radium is a solid, liquid, gas?
Yeah. Well, even if it was a solid, Your Honor, and we do dispute that.
Dispute that it's a solid.
Yes, but even without that, even if you take the radiation aside, coliform bacteria was alleged very clearly in the underlying complaint. And not only are the cases that the insurance companies rely upon to get rid of the coliform bacteria obligation to cover, not only were those summary judgment, but numerous courts around this country have expressly said, after summary judgment, we've looked at the evidence, and coliform bacteria cannot be classified as a solid, liquid, gas, or thermal irritant. And so when the insurance companies read that initial complaint, there was a duty. Now, the two main issues, I think, I believe we've adequately alleged that there was something in, there was an exposure to a material that would have been covered in the underlying complaint. The district court, of course, didn't focus on that. The district court focused effectively on three things. The fact that the word pollution and contaminant was used, and we addressed that in our papers in here today, Your Honor, that the fact that the word pollutant is used is irrelevant because not all pollutants are excluded by the policy. The second thing, and this is interesting, and I think it's noteworthy, every case relied upon by the district court and every case cited by the insurance companies is a summary judgment case enforcing the pollutant exception. The big one that was used is, of course, the Doe Run case, which is very interesting. In that case, the court made clear, this court made clear, there was a fact-intensive issue, fact-intensive analysis. But here's the rub of that, too. In that case, which the district court relied on, the physics question of whether radiation is a solid, liquid, gas, or thermal wasn't alleged. In that case, the products were cadmium and zinc. And this issue, this factual question didn't arise. I think the problem here is that we are being effectively collaterally stopped and forced to depend upon the evidence submitted by others in prior cases that the courts did or didn't find sufficient. And that's improper in a Rule 12c motion. But even if the court were to get there, as you recall, in order for the duty to defend to attach, all that has to happen is one thing in the underlying complaint has to be insurable. And the coliform bacteria, numerous courts have said that's enough. That there's actually cases that come both ways in that particular context, whether the bacteria was or wasn't a solid. And the fact that that exists in our petition should have been sufficient to cause the duty to defend, which leads us to where we are now. With that, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Very well. You may go soon.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Are you going to speak to the jurisdiction point at some point? Or
To the extent the court wants to address it, I'm happy to
do
that.
If you don't want to, that's fine.
And I was going to do it in rebuttal, but I can do it.
It's up to you.
Thank you.
I meant the appellate jurisdiction point.
Oh, yes, sir.
Mr. Hofer? Good morning. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Patrick Hofer for Capital and Employers. I'm here with Abigail Gentle for Employers as well. The District Court properly concluded that it had jurisdiction over this case under CAFA, and it properly granted judgment on the pleadings based on the terms of the policies and Missouri law. Addressing the CAFA issue, there's no dispute that this case satisfies CAFA's jurisdictional requirements with respect to numerosity, amount in controversy, and diversity of citizenship. There's no dispute that CAFA's local controversy exception does not apply here. There's also no dispute that the class representative acts as a class representative seeking relief for the class after obtaining class certification, class judgment from a state court. The only dispute is whether this effort by the class representative seeking to enforce a class judgment that otherwise satisfies all of CAFA's jurisdictional requirements is a class action under CAFA. No case supports the class representative's argument here. The only case on point, Addison Automatics, directly rejects her argument. As Addison held, a new suit that continues a class action to enforce a class judgment is still a class action. Addison was correctly decided and should be followed here. It is consistent with this court's decision in Brown, and it is consistent with the Supreme Court's interpretation of CAFA in Dart Cherokee, which was decided after Addison Automatics. Addison took as a given that had the class representative there acted on behalf of the class explicitly instead of in an individual capacity, it certainly would be a class action. The only question in Addison was whether the class representative's effort to manipulate the pleadings to allege only individual relief somehow made a difference, and the Seventh Circuit said no. Of course, this is still, in substance, a class action. You are acting on behalf of the class, and in reaching that determination, the Seventh Circuit relied heavily on this court's decision in Sondell.
So any action brought by the class representative for any purpose is a class action for CAFA purposes?
If a class representative seeks class relief for over 100 class members seeking over $5 million with diverse citizenship, and CAFA has very elaborate requirements about diversity. The local controversy exception may take out of federal jurisdiction a wide variety of disputes that would come up in a collection context. But if there are over 100, there's over 5 million, the diversity of citizenship, it's a class action under CAFA. And that is Congress's intent. This is a poster child case for why CAFA should extend to disputes involving large amounts of money and abuse of the class process in state courts. And under Missouri law, the class representative here could not have filed this case. She filed it in Missouri State Court. She could not have filed this case unless she complied with the Missouri class action statute. She cannot act as a representative of class members without satisfying Section 507.070.
I think that's conceded.
Well, the fact that it's conceded means that the argument is conceded, because if the class representative cannot file a suit without
otherwise she wouldn't be a class representative.
Well,
right?
What
she, I mean, we know that, right? Don't we?
Well, what the class representative argues is because she doesn't plead, in this case, class issues, that this isn't a class action. But what she does plead repeatedly is that those issues have already been decided. In other words, these aren't allegations to be determined. They're determined, and we're bound by them. So it's pleading with an extra emphasis. Yes, she's a class representative, but she can't have it both ways. She cannot say she acts as a class representative, but this case doesn't involve any class issues. Obviously, that can't be the case. Foremost, any judgment here against the insurers will have to bind all class members. That's only possible if this is a class action. And if this case were not dismissed on the merits, the approval of any settlement or approval of any voluntary dismissal of claims would have to be made by the district court under Rule 23. And the conduct of the class's class representative and class counsel would have to be reviewed by the district court as well. All these are class issues that are part of this case if it were to go forward. Even class certification could be at issue because the underlying certification was not validly obtained and not binding on the insurers here. Indeed, the fact that the class acts under the Missouri class action statute is verified by Sondell, which was cited by Seventh Circuit in Addison. The court in Sondell held that when a class representative files a related state court suit seeking class relief, she acts on behalf of the class, binding the class even if relief is denied. And the reason is privity. The class representative is in privity with the class because of her fiduciary duty to the class, and she has that fiduciary duty because of the class action statute. That's why parens patriae suits are not class actions. The state doesn't need the class action statute to act on behalf of its citizens. It already has that authority. And similarly, an unincorporated association, a member of an unincorporated association, doesn't need class action statute to file a suit on behalf of the association. He or she already has privity with the association under the state statute giving authority to file that suit.
So you're saying that this class action statute will still govern her actions on what she does with this judgment?
Absolutely.
She will continue to be a representative of what is still a class, even though that particular case is over?
She filed this case under Missouri law, and she could only file it seeking relief on behalf of the class under the Missouri class action statute and rule.
She can only file it because of the class action statute. She can only file it because the class action statute gave her standing. Is that what you're saying?
Correct, Your Honor, and that makes this a class action.
That makes it a class action?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, turning to the merits, the district court properly granted judgment on the pleadings because the class's claims have no validity on their face. The question is whether the insurers owe any coverage for an $82 million judgment against our insured Collier. But because the insurers had no duty to defend the underlying suit based on the allegations of the original complaint, what we call the Pratt petition, they had no duty to indemnify the ultimate judgment. This is clear as a matter of law based on the face of the Pratt petition and the terms of the insurer's policies. The petition sought damages for the discharge of pollutants, contaminated water. Those damages are clearly excluded under the terms of the policies. Accordingly, the insurers properly disclaimed a duty to defend and are not stopped to assert any coverage defense for coverage for the judgment. The insurers properly disclaimed the duty to defend because the petition alleged contamination of drinking water with radionuclides, that is, radioactive elements, which must be solid, liquid, or gas, bacteria, and other contaminants.
And what the district court relied on some EPA scientific documents for that?
Correct, Your Honor.
Is that proper at this stage?
Yes. The court essentially took judicial notice of the scientific nature of elements such as radium, and the Supreme Court in Daubert said it's perfectly appropriate. In fact, it may be more appropriate for a court to take judicial notice of the laws of science than it is to subject them to expert opinion. It's perfectly appropriate to observe what radium is. This is something that is not subject to reasonable dispute. That is the language of Federal Rule of Evidence 201 on judicial notice. The class representative now, for the first time, states that she does dispute that radium is a solid. That is actually not the case. She's never asserted that. That assertion is not preserved on appeal. I don't think there is any grounds for any reasonable dispute. Radium is a metal. It's an alkali metal. You can dispute it all you want, but that allegation is not plausible. It doesn't need to be accepted as an allegation.
What about the other alleged contaminant?
Well, there was contamination with bacteria and fluoride and iron.
The bacteria, is that a disputed? Is that disputed as to whether that would fall within the exclusion?
Well, there's an argument that they make, which is that bacteria isn't solid, liquid, or gas. Well, it's solid, liquid, or gas, or some combination. All matter consists of solid, liquid, or gas. I am 75% water as I stand in front of you. But I am solid, liquid, or gas, I guarantee you. I'm not some variety of matter that does not exist. Neither are bacteria. The words in Mr. Berry earnestly argues that the pollution exclusion doesn't apply to all pollutants. Well, yes, it does. It says it applies to all pollutants. And pollutants are defined with words of embracing totality. Solid, liquid, or gas are not words of limitation. That means everything. So there's no reasonable dispute that bacteria are excluded. In fact, one of the cases we cited to the court involving a trailer park with contaminated water said if bacteria are not contaminants, then nothing is. And I think that is the common sense interpretation of this exclusion, which is compelled under Missouri law.
So is it your view that the district court simply relied or took judicial notice, even if it didn't expressly say so, of science, of undisputed science?
Yes, but the court didn't need to do that in order to rule in the insurer's favor, because the only question is whether the allegations in the original complaint, the Pratt petition, brought the claim within coverage. And just reading the allegations of that complaint, it's clear that they're completely excluded. There's no allegation that there's contamination with radioactive emissions. There's contamination with radionuclides and radium, 226 and 228. Those are radioactive isotopes of radium. That is what that was alleged, and the plaintiff is the master of her pleading. She's bound by that. There's no escaping that the basis of the complaint was contamination with pollutants of the water. So the court did not need to examine further. The only reason the court had to get into the question was because of the arguments the class representative makes here, saying, well, you can't look at the Pratt petition. You can only look at what I allege in my complaint in this case, and I allege now alpha particles. Well, that's not Missouri law. Missouri law says the duty to defend is based solely on the allegations in the original complaint. not what happened later at trial, not what was adduced in discovery, and certainly not what the plaintiff creatively alleges in a coverage dispute with the insurer. If you look at the allegations of the complaint, the original complaint, the underlying complaint, you don't need to go into the science of what radium consists of. Mr. Bursch will continue our argument.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. Bursch, good morning. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Bursch on behalf of Owners Insurance. I agree with everything that Mr. Hoffer just said, obviously everything in the district court opinion. I want to add just a few points of emphasis to respond to some of the court's questions. First, with respect to CAFA, it's absolutely clear that the class representative here only has standing to pursue a class judgment. So when Judge Arnold, you made the point in your question, doesn't Rule 23 here give her standing to pursue this action? That's exactly right. She either needs Rule 23 here or she needed Rule 52.08 in the Missouri State Court, the Rule 23 analog, in order to proceed at all because she's trying to effectuate a class judgment. And when my friend on the other side says that there's no class action hallmarks here, that the rules don't apply anymore, that's just wrong. Not only if there was a settlement or a release or a distribution would Rule 23 control that, but if something would happen to Ms. Williams as class representative and another class representative needed to be substituted for her, something which has already happened in this case one time, that would take place under Rule 23. If we needed to replace class counsel, who represented the class both in the initial action and in this collection action, if he needed to be replaced for some reason, that would take place under Rule 23. And then, of course, any distribution of proceeds would take place under Rule 23. So to say that somehow this case doesn't arise under the rule because they very artfully excluded any reference to Rule 23 in their complaint is just ignoring the reality of the situation. And in order to agree with that argument, you would have to create a circuit split and disagree expressly with the Addison decision in the Seventh Circuit. This whole issue of federal jurisdiction, to be honest, is something that they invited. Once they entered into one of these 065 compromise agreements, which is the Missouri compromise statute that allows them to enter into an agreement with the insured, the owner of the property park, at that point, they started to pursue diverse parties, out-of-state insurers. As soon as they did that, that invited removal. That's what triggered CAFA. And if you look at the complaint that they filed in this case, the caption says she's the class representative, as they admit. The second page, it says they're represented by class counsel. Even in the relief that they're requesting, they're asking for judgment in favor of the class. So from the caption to the prayer, this is replete with all the hallmarks of a class action. Just one point that I want to make on the merits about the pollution exclusion, and this goes to the colloquy, Judge Kelly, that you were having with Mr. Hoffer about solids, liquids, and gases. Really, this policy is intended to cover everything. Matter only exists in three forms. So when we're talking about solids, liquids, and gases, we're talking about matter. And what the plaintiffs try to do is they try to take matter and then divide it into smaller and smaller pieces so that it doesn't look like matter anymore. But that would be like saying if there was a sign that prohibited me from leaning on this podium, and I said, well, I'm not leaning on the podium. I'm actually being supported by the protons and the electrons that make up the molecules which make up the wood in the podium. No one would say that this podium is not matter. It's still matter. And so when you're talking about alpha particles, when you're talking about radiation, and when you're talking about bacteria, all of these things, depending on what the temperature is outside, have protons and electrons, which will either be solids, liquids, or gases. And there's no scientific dispute about that. And although the district court was entirely within its purview to look at the EPA documents and take judicial notice of basic science principles, it didn't even need to do that. All it had to do is look at the Pratt petition, which is the only document that matters here. It alleged that there were contaminants in the water. It compared that to the exclusion in the policies, which said if you've got an allegation of contaminants in a liquid which is being propagated, that's excluded from coverage. Any reasonable person would see that and have that exact understanding, and it's simply semantic gymnastics on the part of plaintiffs to try to argue that this is somehow not matter. One final point on the pollution exclusion. The policies also talk about bodily injury or property damage arising out of the propagation of pollutants. And under this court's precedent, specifically the Capital Indemnity Corp case from 2003, unlike the exclusion itself, which you might construe narrowly, the arising out of exception you construe broadly. And all of these things that they're talking about arise out of the contaminants in the water. So any way you slice or dice this, the semantic gymnastics cannot get around the fact that the Pratt petition's allegations fell plainly within the four corners of the plain language of the policy documents. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll just concede the balance of my time.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Berry?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. A few brief thoughts in reply. First, on the larger CAFA jurisdiction issue. Again, I think that the arguments are very clear. Their argument is that she was once a class, or she is a class representative from a prior class action. It should all continue forward. And I think what they've done is they've trotted out a parade of horribles that don't seem to be supported by law about what might happen in this case. Well, maybe she chooses not to be a class representative anymore. Well, of course, this court doesn't have the power to release her as a class representative. She was appointed by the Missouri court, and she has those fiduciary obligations until that issue is resolved. They say that there are, could be settlement issues in this case that raise class issues. Of course, none of those issues are relevant to what this case was filed under. And what remedies she's pursuing, nor is it clear that this case would require this court's settlement approval in the same way a class action would. From our perspective, the class has been certified, judgment and liability have been determined, and all that is happening is that Ms. Williams, as a class representative, is pursuing what every other judgment creditor in Missouri of every other kind has the right to pursue. And what they are arguing is the fact that, incidentally, she happens to represent a class somehow converts 397.200 into a class action when all that's happening is that's who the class creditor is. That's who the judgment creditor is. So none of those arguments change Congress's watchword, which is what was this case filed under? And we think it was clearly filed under 397.200, which has none of the hallmarks. There were a number of discussions on the issue of the merits that I think are relevant to discuss, and counsel was very clear that he thought we were playing gymnastic games and trying to rewrite the policy when the reality, and I think I heard it several times, insurers are implying that their pollution exclusion covers, I think the quote was, either everything or all matter. And the pollution exclusion says neither thing. The gymnastics that they're talking about is us reading the policy. Unless it is a solid, liquid, gas, or thermal irritant or contaminant, it's not covered by their pollution, exclusion. We know whether or not counsel believes that all matter, all human beings are made up of matter, a solid, liquid, or gas. We know courts in this country have, after looking at the evidence, said that's not the case. And we know the chair of the physics department of Washington University said, hang on, alpha particle radiation doesn't fall as a state of matter into any of the things listed in this policy. And so from our perspective, we're not the ones attempting to rewrite the policy. On the last issue, which Your Honor raised, on the actual jurisdiction, we believe, and I think it is undisputed here, that there was no waiver in the October 21st, 2015 order. We agreed to the form of the judgment for the purpose of resolving the case against final.
Right. What about the other jurisdictional point?
Sure. Well, Ms. Williams timely filed the notice of appeal within 30 days of the last defendant being dismissed. We think the Haley case would control, but even if we were wrong, the judge was within his discretion to extend it under Rule 4A, and he did.
He did what?
He extended the time in which we had. We did that timely. It was a matter of his discretion.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. The case is submitted. We will take it under consideration.